We want to talk about the vision, what it means to step out. To do that, I want to turn to Joshua chapter 15. Joshua chapter 15, starting verse 16. It says, and Caleb said, he that smiteth Kiriath-sepher and taketh it, to him will I give Aksa my daughter to wife. And Othniel the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it. And he gave him Aksa his daughter to wife. Probably not the passage of scripture many of you would have expected. But in just a few more minutes, we'll be at the end of this year's conference. And everyone's going to grab something from the food cart so you'll get to stuff your face. But we'd be remiss if we didn't end this conference with a look forward. With a look into the future. See, the call of the conference is for each of us to step out. Step out of the line that our world calls normal. Step out into the calling that God is pulling us towards that we've heard here this weekend. For many, God's calling isn't new to us. We've tried to take the steps out that we've been felt led to take. And unfortunately, we've all likely struggled the first time we tried to take that step. And I believe this is in part because we don't know where we're headed. So we take that step and then we hesitate. So I want to end this conference with a vision of what it means to step up. Using our opening text in Joshua, looking forward to what it means, I want to preach a message entitled The Contrasting Lives of the Grasshopper and the Mountain Goat. Amen. Stay with me. It'll be good. You can be seated. Calophera, more commonly called grasshoppers, are from the scientific order of the Orthoptera. The suborder itself is made up of roughly 2,400 different genera and roughly 11,000 different species worldwide. They grow to the average size of about 2 inches long, and although they're found on a fairly regular basis to have grown up to sizes longer than 5 inches. And they can currently be found in abundance on every continent in the world except Antarctica. So much so that their official conservation status is listed as of least concern. So, with the grasshopper infestation that appears to be all over our globe, it isn't surprising that their existence is found in art, in writing, in the history of many different cultures across our globe. Currently, they're considered a protein staple in Asia and Africa, and to a lesser extent, South America. And it's this use as a protein that's one of our more popular references to grasshoppers in the Bible, isn't it? Where the diet of John the Baptist was referenced as locusts and honey. Now, for those really smart people that caught on to the fact that it says locusts in Matthew chapter 3 and not grasshoppers, we'll cover that in a little bit. But for right now, I'm going to ask that you trust me that they come from the same egg. All right? For those of you thinking how rough life must have been for poor old John having to eat grasshoppers to survive, don't worry too much because apparently they are considered quite yummy. I've read that they're good dusted with chili powder, roasted with garlic, sprinkled with lime juice, or better yet, if you ground them up and you make a salsa out of them, or dusted on the outside of orange slices, they're supposed to be delicious. Now, I know that we have food carts waiting just outside, but if the thoughts of these yummy grasshoppers inspire you to expand your taste buds, you want to do some shopping after the conference, you may have better luck shopping for them under the name Chapulines. Now, here's a pro tip. Getting the best price for grasshoppers is all about timing. It really is, because if you buy them shortly after they're harvested, they can actually be fairly reasonable. But later in the year, the prices rise significantly, often tripling as warehouses diminish. But for anybody who's worried, don't worry. I already checked on the prices for you. Right now, you can get your chapulines for only $3.74 an ounce. So to put that in proper perspective, if you like ribeye and you want to get that baby ribeye of 8 ounces, instead of that, why don't you try grasshoppers instead? And you can get the same amount of tummy-filled satisfaction for only $29.90 for the same amount of that 8-ounce steak. Everybody's, you can Google it later. All right, moving back to this message, we won't really be addressing grasshoppers the way that John the Baptist used them, but I know everybody's probably hungry, and I wanted to give options. Because options are always good, right? Instead of food, I want to look at another well-known reference to grasshoppers in the Bible found in Numbers chapter 13. It says, "And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it.' But the men that went with him said, 'We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they brought up an evil report of the land, which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, 'The land through which we have gone to search it, it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. And all the people that we saw in it were men of great stature. And we saw their giants, sons of Anak, which came of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so we were in their sight.'" Now, it's a scripture many of us have probably heard, but I've always kind of scratched my head at this reference a little bit. Why grasshoppers? What was it that made themselves see themselves as grasshoppers? Now, maybe it's always just been referenced that they're tiny, but if you're tiny, why not ants? Ants are everywhere, too. I mean, it's no more realistic that they were actually the size of a grasshopper than an ant. If they saw themselves as weak, why not slugs? I mean, they don't even have a backbone, right? If they didn't fit in, why not fish out of water? We have tons of references that they could have used. They could have picked any animal. Why did they say they were like grasshoppers? Now, I believe the answer lies in the overly simple life of the grasshopper. For all intents and purposes, a grasshopper lives a life completely void of purpose or direction. Bees pollinate, ants prepare. All of nature serves a purpose and does something. The grasshopper, it eats. It either eats until it dies, or it eats until it's eaten. See, a grasshopper's predators vary in size from very large to very small. The complete list of predators is impossible to fully make because grasshopper is prey to pretty much everything. If it moves, it likely eats a grasshopper. To kind of show some of this, here are some of the more common predators of the grasshopper. Rats, spiders, birds, lizards, monkeys, bats, foxes, coyotes, snakes, mice, raccoon, fish, bees, beetles, crickets, ants, dragonflies, toads, frogs, hornets, fungus, bacteria, and sadly, even the common housefly. Their defensive abilities are so severely lacking that they make extremely easy pickings for pretty much everything. While a few species have developed some defensive abilities, such as vomiting on whatever eats them, for the most part, the defense is limited to that of simply jumping. But if I say jumping, I'm actually giving the grasshopper a little too much credit. Because scientists don't say that grasshoppers jump, because that would imply a sense of control that they simply don't have. Instead, it's more accurate to say that grasshoppers catapult themselves. In a simple reflexive action, they simply fling themselves backwards. And if they've lived long enough to develop their wings, they'll try to land somewhere safely. Otherwise, they simply thud down. And when a grasshopper lands, guess what he does? He goes back to eating. If he doesn't land on a plant to eat, he continues to catapult himself over and over again until he lands on food. It is completely driven by its belly and its lust, which brings us to the locust. See, when a grasshopper can't eat itself to death and food becomes scarce, serotonin is released into the grasshopper, triggering an emotional outburst of energy into their system. And they reproduce faster and change their physical form, becoming larger and more aggressive. And as the population continues to increase, they begin to form into a swarm, devouring everything they can find. Until they've wiped out all food sources they can find and die off from starvation. This larger, more aggressive grasshopper is what is commonly referred to as a locust. Now, I'm not sure the Israelites understood the full ramifications of what they were saying. But by declaring that they saw themselves only as grasshoppers, they made the most accurate and profound comparison they possibly could. While they no doubt desired their freedom from slavery, They didn't really want to be free from the real master, which was their own lust. See, as we watch the nation of Israel travel to the promised land, they're continually swinging with every emotional tide that comes along, living high on full bellies and full wallets as Egyptians paid them to leave, they rejoice. Then weep as they thought they were dead men as the Egyptian army was tracking them down. Then they rejoice on the other side of the Red Sea, watching the army drowned. And once again, their bellies are filled with triumph. The emotional tide swings back as Moses is on the mountain too long. And they fill their religious need with making an image to worship. When they come to Mara to get a drink and find out the water isn't safe, they turn into a swarm of proverbial locusts attacking Moses and God to fill their need. Over and over, the pattern repeats itself. No water, swarm. Water comes out of a rock, they fill their bellies. No food, swarm. Manna from heaven, they fill their bellies. Sick of manna, swarm. Quail as far as the eye can see, they fill their bellies. It's a pattern that repeated itself over and over again. You see, when Israel went to Egypt, they lived off the best of the land during the life of Joseph. When he died, the Egyptians made them slaves. But before this happened, they had already been enslaved to their own lusts, living in the life of lap of luxury for too long. When we see all the things they complained about missing in the wilderness, we see that, yes, they may have been slaves, but their lives weren't without their luxuries. They had their niceties in Egypt. It's one thing to murmur and complain about how things are going. It's a whole different story when we're asked to do something about it. A lot of times we're too comfortable where we are to actually want to get up and change. See, their great-grandfathers may have understood how blessed they were, but by the time of the Exodus, they were four generations into the Egyptian lifestyle and mindset. And that was a grasshopper mentality. Fill my belly before I turn into a destructive swarm. That was a mentality that God simply could not allow to continue. As a result, for 40 years, Israel would be forced to wander through the wilderness until that grasshopper mentality had been destroyed. There was a purging that had to happen, and a mindset that had to be completely removed. The future of Israel was going to be given to a generation that was raised in the wilderness, not in Egypt. A generation that wasn't driven by their bellies. No more dependent on the luxuries of their culture. They would learn what it meant to walk by faith. Listen, we live in a culture that wants to tell us how we're supposed to walk. But will we be willing to walk by faith? And now what they tell us is the right thing. They learned to trust on God's providence and to depend on His direction as He led them through the wilderness. After 40 years, the next generation would have a totally different thought process. Gone would be the grasshopper mentality. This generation would be defined by something complete, something else. And they would take on the characteristics of two men that didn't succumb to the swarming mentality the first time around when they first went to the promised land. The two men who could see beyond the thoughts and the fears of the swarm. The two men that stepped out at this crucial juncture were Joshua and Caleb. So we know the stories of Joshua fighting the battle of Jericho, conquering the promised land, demanding of Israel to make a stand and to determine who they would serve. The Bible goes on to record that Israel served God until all the men who had been influenced by Joshua died. Joshua definitely has hold of something powerful, didn't he? He couldn't be a victim simply because he was different. Joshua stepped out as a conqueror. And as powerful as the testimony of Joshua is, the story of Caleb may be an even more vivid representation of the mindset of a conqueror instead of a victim. We read in Joshua 14, starting at verse 6, it says, "Then the children of Judah came unto Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me to Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware on that day, saying, Surely the land whereupon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance, and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years. For those that don't like math, that's 85. Well, no, we'll get to that. I'm sorry. He's 45. But he talks about, never mind, we'll get there. Even since the Lord spake this unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, and lo, now I am this day 85 years old. That's 85, see? I said we'd get there. And yet as I am as strong this day as I was in the day of Moses sent me out, as my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war both to go out and to come in. Now therefore give me this mountain, whereof the Lord has spoken that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and that the cities were great and fenced. If so, the Lord will be with me. Then shall I be able to drive them out, as the Lord has said. See, what Caleb was saying was, hey, Joshua, you remember those giants that scared our nation away? Let me at them. That mountain, that's my inheritance. Those cities, those are mine. Those fortresses, those are mine. We may have been wandering around the wilderness for the last 40 years. But I'm not living down there with the grasshoppers. My home is on the mountaintop. Listen, the enemy thought he won. He thought we ran away. But we're back and we're stronger than we ever were. I didn't get weaker. I'm not tired. I'm not run down. I'm ready to fight. And I still have strength to go out to war. But better than that, he said, I have strength to come back in. That means I don't lose this battle. I won't be the one who's defeated. For 40 years, we've been preparing for this. We cleaned up our mindset. We changed our thinking. No longer are we driven about by our lusts. Instead, we've learned that where God leads, I'm going to follow. Where he goes, that's where I'm going. For 40 years, if the cloud moves, so do we. We're no longer pampered in the labs of luxury of Egypt. Instead of trusting Egypt to provide what we need, we've learned to depend on God Almighty for it. In short, we've lost this grasshopper mentality. Now let me get my mountain so I can be who God promised me that I would be that day that I stepped out. No longer living with the grasshoppers. But I want to live up where the mountain goats are. Now I must admit, when God gave me this message, he simply gave me the title. It's a pretty unique title for a message. And a mountain goat was not the first animal that comes to mind when I'm thinking about Caleb. Just being honest. Outside of sharing the same territory of living on the mountaintop, when the Lord gave me this message, I didn't see a connection at first. I scratched my head more than once trying to make sure that God didn't somehow mix it up or I heard wrong. You meant the mountain lion, God, right? Not the mountain goat. But each time he pointed me back to the same direction. So I stopped trying to correct God. And I started doing some studying. The Rhamnos Americanus from the subfamily, the Caprinae, the tribe of the Namahorhidini. The mountain goat is a lone member of the genus Oramos. It didn't take much research to find out that the mountain goat isn't really a goat at all. In fact, science isn't sure what to make of it. Based on the evolutionary chart, the closest members of any species science can attribute to the mountain goat are the antelope and the ox. Basically, they're a ridiculous mix of a 90-pound antelope and a half-ton ox. Really, that's science's best guess as to what a mountain goat is. A springy cow that dances daintily across the mountaintops. Okay, God, I am now completely confused, but strangely intrigued. So I continue studying. And I found out that the mountain goat is truly an amazing and unique creature. They're not especially quick or fast, but in relation to the lack of food resources in their habitat, they're extremely large, with the average male growing over 250 pounds or the size of a baby elephant. Mountain goats are lauded in every article I found for their balance and special hoof design. And their balance is undeniable, able to turn that entire 250-pound body in a complete circle, standing on a piece of rock no bigger than 12 inches in diameter. So I wanted to find out more about these special hooves, right? And what I found is that they're split and had a pad in the back. Okay, I mean, that kind of makes sense. A split hoof would provide slightly wider base and more stability and potentially more surface contact, right? So these special hooves must belong to other animals who lived in the highest ranges and rocky terrains, right? Well, as we mentioned, the mountain goats are the only member of their genus. But when we go a level higher to their tribe, we find that every animal in the tribe shares the same hooves of the mountain goats. All right, now we're getting something. Surely all these animals will live in mountain ranges or rocky areas to take advantage of that hoof design, right? No, only one does. The rest live in grasslands and hill country. That's an odd use for these special hooves. Maybe there are other animals that share the abilities of these special hooves besides just those in their scientific tree. And looking it up, I found some. A tapir and a pig. Not exactly the hall of fame of the most skilled climbers in the animal kingdom. So let's summarize what we know about the mountain goat so far. It's a slow, fat, hairy, unremarkable cow deer. Looking further, the natural enemies of the mountain goat definitely jumped out. These are their predators. The grizzly bear, the bobcat, golden eagles, wolves, and mountain lions. Now that's an impressive list of predators. With enemies like that, their lack of speed, and their surprisingly large size, the mountain goat makes a big, easy target and a satisfying meal when it's trying to run away. And this is where we learn what really makes this creature special. Because despite the lack of ability and the Hall of Fame list of predators lining up to eat it, more mountain goats die from old age and their own missteps than all those predators combined. And the reason is simply because the mountain goat lives at a level that their enemies can't reach. See, physically, they're not special. They aren't the strongest. They're not the fastest. They're not the leanest or the smartest. And yet they can reach heights that few animals can reach. A mountain goat's able to traverse more than 1,500 vertical feet up the side of a mountain in only 20 minutes' time. They do have one predator able to follow them into their mountaintop home, and that's the mountain lion. And as long as they live above that timberline, they have only one enemy to fear. And this brings us to the second unique characteristic of the mountain goat. They don't like to run away. See, while they aren't typically aggressive to human beings, when they're threatened, they're known to ignore the flee part of the fight-flee instinct. Even in battles with other mountain goats, they don't ram heads like sheep or rams or other deer do. Instead, they aim their horns for the soft part of the body to end the fight as quickly as possible. They don't play games with danger. The mountain goat eliminates it. See, this boldness means that predators, even the far superior mountain lion, must get behind the mountain goat in order to defeat it. This slow, fat, unspectacular animal has been witnessed fending off attacks from full-grown groups of wolves despite being completely outclassed. See, they don't turn away and run from trouble. That's the grasshopper. The mountain goat meets whatever dares to face him head on. And this is a challenge. And this is a challenge to the men and women who are willing to answer the call of God to step out. Listen, the road may be tough. The one that has stepped out is the one that's willing to scale the mountaintop in 20 minutes' time. If there's a need in the church, they are the one who's willing to drop whatever they're doing and be there to help. If their pastor is tiring out, they're the ones that get under his arms and lift him up so the battle isn't lost. If there's a family in need, they're the ones who are there willing to serve. This is a child of God that's willing to stare down the mouth of the lion and press forward, not back down. The only place a Christian isn't covered in the army of God is on their back. See, when we back down from our stand, just like the mountain goat, we make easy prey. But when we stand tall, the enemy doesn't stand a chance. This is why we must step out and step up. Because a child of God should never be destroyed at the hand of the enemy. Let me say that again. There is no person here, no individual here that should ever be destroyed because the enemy takes them out. We haven't been called to live in the grassy plains and become easy prey to anything around us. We've been called to live in the mountaintops. The Bible says that the devil is looking for who he can devour. What that tells me is he knows he can't hit you head on. He can only circle in hopes that you back down. See, it's these characteristics that we see in the conversation we read about between Joshua and Caleb. Caleb wasn't some particular or spectacular specimen of a man. He was an 85-year-old geezer who didn't realize that his time was supposed to have passed. See, it didn't matter to Caleb that he was too old to go to war. It didn't matter that the air was supposed to be too thin for his aging lungs on the mountaintop. It didn't matter that he would face a mountain full of giants manning impenetrable mountain defenses and fortresses. In fact, this only made him believe that he couldn't fail. Why? Because that mountain was his inheritance. That mountain was his promise. And if it was impossible for him, that meant that God was going to fight for him. See, if he couldn't make it up the mountain, then God was going to give him the strength. If the thin air didn't matter because it was the breath of God that was flowing through his lungs. Listen, he may have spent the last 40 years in the wilderness, but all that did was strengthen his resolve. All it did was teach him how to trust God, how to walk with God, how to lean on God. You see, he wasn't a slave in Egypt, but he learned how to be a warrior in the wilderness. The bigger and the badder the mountain became, the bigger and the better the blessing Caleb knew was coming his way. This was his mountain. This was his blessing. This was his inheritance. He knew that the journey couldn't end until he received his promise. Listen, we received a call from God. That means your journey doesn't end until God fulfills it. If you're willing to step out and stay stepped out. See, he wasn't called to live in the wilderness. There was a seed that was planted in his heart. And he could not be satisfied until he reached the level God that he had stepped out to take. He was called to live on the mountaintop. We need this hyphen generation of this state and this nation to understand that the call has been made. That now is the time. Now is when we take the step. When we look the state our world is in, it's not time to be satisfied. It's not time to try to get comfortable. We're standing at the end of the wilderness. And we're looking at the beginning of our mountain. So who's willing to step out? Someone needs to understand that we're not created to live in the grasshopper mentality. And if we're honest, too many of us have lived there for too long. You don't need to be controlled by the winds of life anymore. You don't need to be riding the currents of fear and doubt as things come and things happen and life changes you and directs you and it leads you. You're no longer bound to the wilderness. It's time to take the mountain God has called you to take. The first thing we must do is to be willing to surrender that grasshopper mentality. Surrender the despair and the fear that comes when we see the mountains of life. And instead, trust that God has called you to be much more than what happens around you. We're not meant to be simply the circumstances in our life. We must surrender that mentality. And what we do next determines whether we head back to the fields and fill our bellies, or we step out and fulfill the calling in our life to live above the storms. It's not enough to be satisfied with just a step out to get to the altar at a conference. Even if you did it after every message, that's great. And it's just the beginning. Because we are standing on the threshold of a very, very open door. Behind us are the plains, but ahead of us is a mountain. And we can't stop here. We can't settle for gorging ourselves in the grass of the plains where we sit on the threshold of our promise, of our fulfillment, of what God is calling this generation to do, to be, to achieve, to reach, to fight, to defeat. So the question is, what will we do now? What is your promise? What's your inheritance, young man? What is your burden, lady of God? What is the mountain that God has called you to walk? What is the path that He's placed in your heart at this conference to start down? The message of this conference is whatever it is that God's calling you to do, now is the time to step out. The promise is yours for the taking. It's time we had enough of patty cake Christianity. It's time for the Calebs of this generation to step out and take their mountain. This isn't about trying to survive on the mountaintop experiences from one spiritual high to the next. It's not about the highs or the lows. Instead, it's about changing where we live. Changing where we exist. It's more than just a step at the end of a conference. Yes, it can start here. But this is about looking towards your promise, looking towards your future, and refusing to be turned aside from the mountain trail you're called to walk, because you have a promise, you have an inheritance, and it's not the distractions that are going to turn you aside. As we read our story, we find that there's a steely determination in Caleb. But the real power of this story doesn't stop with the life of Caleb. The magic of his life was that the next generation would take up his cause. In our opening text, when facing the final city that stood on his mountain, Caleb called for somebody else to step out and take the city. Maybe it was the thin air that was finally getting to his aging lungs. Maybe it was his 85-year-old body was starting to give way. Or maybe he just wanted to see who was willing to step out. Who would take the step to be the next leader. Whatever the reason, he said, I want someone else to go take that city. And it was Caleb's nephew, Othniel, who chose to step out. The same call made by Caleb on his mountain is a call of this conference. We've been so blessed to have our bishop and his wife, along with Brother Scott Graham, invest in us and challenge us and push us to be who God's calling us to be. Now the question we have to ask ourselves is, am I really willing to step out? Am I really willing to take the steps that God's calling me to take? The message Caleb gave on the mountaintop was this. We are not going to give the enemy any foothold. We're not going to let him have any stronghold. But I want to know, who wants this mountain as bad as I do? Who's willing to step out and take the stand that I'm going to take? Who's willing to be who God's called me to be? I want to know, who wants this mountain as bad as me? It isn't enough for Bishop Putnam to conquer his mountain. Let me say that again. He's conquered a lot of mountains. He's not done yet. But it's not enough for him to do the work that he's done. It's not enough for Brother Scott Graham to do the work that he's done. Who in this conference is willing to fight with him? Sometimes we look at generations and we separate ourselves. But the Bible teaches a different principle. It teaches the elders to train the younger. They're not fighting a different fight than you are. They're not walking a different path than you are. Will we have the boldness, the courage, and the integrity to step out and fight with them? As the musicians come, the name Othniel is not a name that that flows freely from pulpits across our fellowship. But it's interesting because the book of Joshua is not the last place he's mentioned in the Bible. We find in the first chapter of the book of Judges that it repeats the story of Caleb and Othniel. And after Joshua, Caleb, and the leaders who outlived them all passed on, we find in Judges chapter 3 that Israel turns away from serving God. The Lord turns them over to the hand of the king of Mesopotamia. And the cycle that would repeat itself time and time again in Israel's history, Israel repents and turns to the Lord. And in their repentance, God raises up the first judge of Israel. We find this in Judges chapter 3, verse 9. It says, "And when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord raised up a deliverer to the children of Israel, who delivered them, even Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother." The first judge of Israel was the same Othniel who was willing to step out when Caleb called. I hope this sinks in for some of us here. Verse 11 goes on to tell us that the rest of the life of Othniel, Israel had rest and peace. The same Othniel who was willing to step out was the one God called when it was time. Because he prepared, he walked, and he didn't lose his vision. If you can stand with me. When Caleb and Joshua first stepped out of the grasshopper mindset, the results of their step did not end with their generation. That generation died in the wilderness. It didn't end with the next one. But it passed on to the third generation. We've heard from our elders. But are we willing to step out? It doesn't matter your position, what you do in your church, your gender, your status. It's time for every man and woman in this place to determine, I want my mountain. I'm willing to step out. We need our Othniels to step out and step up. We need the children of God who are willing to say, you know what? I'm changing here. I'm changing now. See, Revelation 3:8 says, "Behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast a little strength and hast kept my word and hast not denied my name." As we end this conference, I want to challenge you. You've come down to the altar. You received your calling. You've listened. You've been poured into. Now the time is determined to say, you know what? I'm fixing my vision on that mountain. I'm going to remember what God called me to do, and I'm not going to back down. Before we finish, why don't we take some time to find a place to pray? Say, God, give me courage, give me vision, give me sight about what you want me to do. It's time for this generation of young adults to step into their promise. Let's find a place to pray.